Yankees win!
They have completed the greatest comeback in Super Bowl history.
We lost a $900 million bid to buy the LA Rams.
Look, that contract extension was for $176 million.
The stadium will cost $1.1 billion.
Champions are made and cash always follows. But where did it all start? These are the true stories of the blockbuster sports deals that went down in the locker room, boardroom, and between the lines that made many people very, very wealthy. From Entrepreneur Media, this is The Playbook. I'm CEO of Sports One Marketing and your host, Dave Meltzer.
I have one of our partners today, one of my childhood heroes, not that he's that much older than I am, although he does look it. I have Jim Leyritz, the King of New York, in the house, normally on the Sports Blender, on Sports Biz, the SB Nation, but now he's on Entrepreneur as a businessman. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing good, David.
Oh, this is so much fun.
I was gonna say, this is fun. This is fun.
This is good. I don't know where to start, but you know, I'm gonna start, Jim, because you have such an interesting story that a lot of people don't know about. And so I'm gonna start with you being at not at Kentucky. Actually, you were being recruited out of high school, drafted, and tell us about where you were going to be drafted and what happened in the baseball draft.
Yeah, my path to the big league wasn't the normal path that most guys would take. Like we just watched the kids the other day here in California get drafted.
Yeah, shortstop, right?
Yeah, the shortstop.
Hopefully, he's not Matt Bush.
Boyce or whatever his name is.
Right.
But no, I mean it was one of those things. When I was in high school, I was playing. My teammate was Barry Larkin. And Barry was going to be the number one pick out of Cincinnati that year. I was supposed to be the number two pick behind him. And it would, June 4th came, and I was getting ready to go out and play tennis with one of my buddies. And, you know, you don't think playing tennis is anything big. So I left to go play tennis, was gone. That we went out and played. And the first set that we played tennis, I went up for a smash, and I fractured my foot.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, oh, man. So I went home. I mean, I went to the hospital, had it checked out. Sure enough, it was fractured. The doctor put, and it was just a light cast. It wasn't a big, you know, wasn't anything broken. It was just a fracture. He said, you'll be out for, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, you know, and you'll be better. So I was like, okay, no big deal. And I walk home and I walk in the door and my dad looks at my foot and he goes, what the heck happened to you? I said, Dad, it's not a big deal. I fractured playing. He was like, Jimmy, the draft's in 2 days. He said, I just got a phone call from the Atlanta Braves. They were going to make you a draft pick. Now I've got to tell him that you got a broken foot and you can't. He goes, you just blew any opportunity at getting drafted.
So let me just stop you there because most people don't know baseball like you and I do. So back then, what year was it?
This is 1982.
1982. When you break your foot and you're a top draft pick, the teams automatically know. Oh, yeah. There's no calling the teams nowadays. Usually there's some kind of leak. They're going right from any ambulance, hospital, police report, right to all the major league teams, especially a few weeks or days before the draft. So now there's kind of a moral dilemma for you, right? Because you, in those days, you don't have to call the team.
Right? Oh, it was a moral dilemma for me, but my dad's not that kind of guy.
Right, which I like, right? He's like, you have to call the team and tell them. And so I take it the teams didn't draft you in the first round.
No, they called back. They called back the next because the question was whether I wanted to go to college or not, whether I was signable. You know, back in then they did all this. It wasn't like it is now. It was like, okay, they're going to find out whether or not you want to go to college because back then they kind of encouraged you to,
right?
You know, so you could mature more. And they wanted to know what my desire was. And my dad said, "Listen, make an offer, and we'll go from there." You know, and they called back the next day, and my dad said, "Well, unfortunately, we got a broken leg now." And the scout said to my dad, he said, "Well, listen, he plays on the Midland Redskins, which is our big travel team that Larkin and we all played for." He said, "You know what? If he can get healthy in 6 weeks, maybe we'll take another look at him at the end of the summer and see if he's capable." Well, the unfortunate thing was the bone that I broke was the Bill Walton break, which was right on where your foot like pivots,
right,
or just bends, and I was a catcher. And that was the only position I had played all of high school. So I couldn't squat on it for a couple of years. And so I had to go to college, and I had to now learn to play other positions.
What position?
So I ended up playing at the junior college I went to in Georgia. I ended up playing third base in the outfield.
And then going to Kentucky.
And then I didn't get drafted. Both years I didn't get drafted out of there. Led the league in hitting, but I still couldn't catch. And what I didn't know, when I found out later after, you know, Kentucky, was that they really wanted me as a catcher. That I could hit.
Right.
But they preferred me as a catcher as far as position goes.
Right. And you know I'm a laws of the universe guy. So tell everyone, because I think I'm a Buckeye, you're a Buckeye. I'm from Akron, you're from right outside Cleveland. But tell everyone how you became a catcher, right? Because now you're not going to be really drafted until you can catch. But you weren't a catcher when you were a little kid, nor did you really want to be one. I think this is one of the coolest stories. So tell us what happened.
Yeah, this was a huge story, you know, for as far as an influence on me as a kid. And one of the reasons why I never take when a kid comes up to me for granted, because you just never know when you could change a life. And this happened to me. I was 12 years old. I was at spring training with the Reds. One of my closest friends was Tommy Brenneman. And Tommy used to take me to spring training every year with him. And we happened to be out there one day on the field, and Eric Parsegian's World of Sports came in to film a couple episodes.
Who's from Akron, Ohio.
Exactly.
Eric Parsegian, coach of Notre Dame, by the way. Get all my tidbits in.
That's it. And they were doing two segments. And at this time, I was 12 years old. I played the outfield, shortstop. I was the athlete, so I did all the positions except catch. And Pete Rose was doing hitting. Johnny Bench was doing catching. Pete Rose at this time was my idol. I was the big red machine, right?
70s?
70s, yeah. And I was praying that Pete would pick me. This was 1975. Oh. I was praying that Pete would pick me to do the hitting. Well, he picked Tommy, and I ended up doing the catching with Johnny Bench. And we did the segment. We did all these drills. And, you know, after it was all over with, Johnny came up to me. He says, "Hey, kid, you know, nice job today." He said, "You know, are you a catcher?" I said, "No, Mr. Bench, I play shortstop, center field. You know, Pete's my idol."
Right,
exactly. Yeah. Pete's my idol. I go, I want to be like Pete. He's like, "Well," he goes, "you know, catching's the quickest way to the big leagues, and you got a good arm, and you're quick and everything else." He said, "You ought to think about that." And I said, "Oh, well, you know, I'm 12 years old." I was like, "Yeah, okay, sure."
Right.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, I think he could tell that I wasn't really
enthused
at it. And he looked at me and said, "Well, maybe this will help." He took off his catcher's mitt, and he signed it to me.
Wow.
And from that day on, I went home that night and told my dad, "I'm going to be a catcher." And from that point on, I became a catcher. And it was great, because here's Johnny had no idea that this happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a great career. I go on to play. My career's over with. I'm retired now. And now I'm playing in a game in 2006 at the Hall of Fame. And Johnny happens to be there. And I'd seen Johnny a couple times, but never enough to talk to him.
Sure.
And this time I was in the locker room with him. And I walked up to him and I said, "Hey, Johnny, I just want to tell you thank you." He said, "For what?" He goes, "You know, he knew I was from Cincinnati. He knew I grew up over there." And he said, "For what?" I said, "Well, you changed my life." And he said, "How?" I said, "Well, you know, when I was in spring training as a kid." He's like, "Oh, you like the Reds?" I go, "No." I go, "I did a TV show with you called the Eric Parsegian World of Sports." He goes, "You're that kid?" I go, "Yeah." I go, "That day I became a catcher."
You never know the ripple effect, right? I love that. In fact, I have to thank you, because my 7-year-old Miles, he's a huge Jim Leyritz fan, obviously.
Right.
And, you know, he wants to be a catcher. It cost me a few $100 in catcher gear that doesn't fit him. But I believe, you know, that's a great position for him.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I think it's really cool, because at that age, especially, to get focused in on that position, you can really, and to understand the game, because, you know, what I like about catchers is it's, you know, not only still the easiest way to get into the league, but moreover, you learn the game better than anyone else. That's why so many managers, the greatest managers are catchers.
Well, yeah, I mean, the reason why, and it's not only because, first of all, you see the whole game in front of you. So you know what every position has to do, where they're supposed to be, where they're supposed to line up. So if you don't become a catcher and you go on to be something else at a young age, you know, it's going to help Miles all the way to learn other things too.
Right.
But I think for me, especially at the big league level and the minor league level, the thing that we become such great managers is because we deal with all the personalities.
And the pitchers.
Yeah, that's exactly. You know, we got 11 pitchers that we have to make sure, and every one of them is not the same.
Yeah.
So you have to figure out every day when you go to the ballpark how to get the most out of that pitcher, and then whatever reliever comes in, how to get the most out of him. And I think that's really why, like I said, you learn the game so much, but you also learn personalities. And I think a great manager isn't not just a guy that knows the game, but also knows how to handle those people.
Like Madden.
To get the most out of each player every day.
Because
there's good days and bad days when you play 162 games in 180 days.
Yeah, so. No doubt. But now you go on to have this career, which is really interesting to me, because, you know, you are, like I said, one of my heroes, because I look for clutch guys. Right, it's one thing, and I hate to knock on him as I always do, but my old friend Eric Harris, you know, it's one thing to be the home run leader of the Los Angeles Dodgers, bat 300 and 100 RBIs every year, but if you're not winning World Series and you're not winning games with those hits, you know, what are they worth? If you're not making the big play, and you have all these different guys throughout baseball that somehow they make the big hit, and those are more valuable. And you've been that guy not only for the Yankees and hitting one of the biggest home runs in the history of the Yankees, right? You can't still 20 years later go into an Atlanta airport without people booing you
exactly.
or wanting to tell you that you ruined your life. But moreover, even for the Padres, right? It's, yeah. I mean, for me as a Padre fan, just to go to the World Series is like equivalent to the Yankees winning 3 World Series in a row.
Right.
That's a good rarity,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, that's all great, and everyone knows you're the king of New York, and I love that. But I like to get a little bit more deep on the business side of things. And, you know, you've had your challenges like me.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, you're my mentor because you helped me illuminate and say, Dave, look, everybody's human. We make mistakes, but you got to illuminate them. You can't hide from them. They're going to come out. And, you know, if you're comfortable, I'd love to learn a little bit about the most challenging time in your life and how you and what you did to overcome it. Because these entrepreneurs out there, they get the challenges and they quit, right? Persistence, you know, it's omnipotent. It, determination and persistence, that's what makes you successful, not genius, talent, or education. So give me a little bit of feedback on what exactly happened for this huge challenge in your life. Before we continue the interview, here's a word from our sponsor. Champions have tools that help them win, ranging from the strict diets to the shoes they choose to wear. When they go to the boardroom, a single tool stands out to make sure they are productive and get the best deal possible. Their Black Moleskine Notebook from Best Self Company. Check out the Best Self Journal at bestself.co. That's bestself.co. Okay, let's get back to the interview.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, after having a great career, like, you know, I wrote a book called, it was originally called The King and Dad, and it was all about beating the odds, making it to New York, undrafted, you know, playing for the Yankees, the biggest team, the biggest stage, and then having that moment that every kid dreams of hitting a World Series home run and, you know, all these things and playing in front of those fans. I mean, it was a challenge every single day. And I think a lot of that prepared me for a lot of other things that I would go through later in life. And of course, after my career was over with, I had the accident where I was on trial for DUI manslaughter for 3 years.
Oh.
And it was one of those things that we always talk about how the truth vibrates the quickest.
Yep.
And I knew the truth was, okay, I didn't go through the light. I didn't cause the accident, but I was on trial for that. And there was a state attorney running to become a judge who had a name and was going to use that name to try to advance her career. And of course, I said, you know, you had to understand, too, there was a death involved. And there was a woman that passed away during the accident. But there was a woman that was also drinking and driving, was doing, you know, text messaging. There was a lot of things that were definitely in my favor that I said, listen, I know I didn't cause this accident. I am guilty. And like, this is what you just talked about, taking responsibility or accountability, was I took the accountability that, yes, I was drinking and driving and I should get a DUI. And that's the first thing I told my attorney was, I will take a DUI. And first time offense, you know, first time I've had any issues with alcohol, first time offense, I'll take it. Because that's what I was guilty of. And the state attorney would not go for that. She said, I'm going to take you to, you're going to go to jail, all these other things. The best thing that they were going to give me was a 10-year probation, 5 years, no license, and a felony on my record.
Ugh.
And at that time, I was just building my career back up after, you know, playing baseball in TV and radio. And I was thinking about coaching. And I knew at a college level, with a felony on my record, I would never get that opportunity. And I had kids that were growing up that I would want to coach them one day. And with a felony, you can't do that. And I told my attorney, there's no way. There's no way I will accept that. And, you know, that's not what I did. I drank and I drove and I want that responsibility. Long story short, we spent 3 years.
And a ton of money.
And just not even that, just the stress on custody of children, kids growing up, you know, like Daryl Strawberry's and Steve House kids had to grow up, but the fans yelling about how bad their father is and everything else.
And New York fans, they're so nice.
Right, exactly. But I will say this, they were very supportive.
Yeah.
They were very supportive because they kind of knew the details when they spoke to me. And I said, listen, I'm never going to see a day in jail.
Yeah.
I didn't cause this accident, but I am guilty of drinking and driving. And it took 3 years. It was, like I said, during that time, though, one of the things that I didn't do was just sit around and sulk. Mm-hmm. I didn't sit around and go, woe is me. I said, you know what? How am I going to beat this? I know the truth is on my side. How can I get the truth to vibrate the fastest? And for me, it was a matter of, I went on the internet, and thank God you had the internet. You know?
Yeah.
And thank God, I went on and I looked up cases of DUIs, you know, other cases that were DUI, two drunk drivers involved,
yeah.
you know, things that were just so unique to this case
yeah.
How were they defended? How did this work? How did things, you know, and find out. And then I came out to California for the first time. I had met a girl who is now my wife.
Yep.
And I read a book called The Purpose Driven Life. It was by this pastor named Rick Warren. I met this girl in New York. She didn't know anything about baseball, anything about what I was doing. And she asked me how I was getting through everything that I was going through. It's a longer story than that, but get about it, buy the book. It's in the book.
Right.
But she said, okay, listen, you know, how do you get through this? You're facing 15 years in jail. You got custody of your children. Your ex-wife is living in your house. But you seem normal.
Right.
And I said, well, I read this book called The Purpose Driven Life by this pastor named Rick Warren. And she looked at me and turned white. And I said, what's wrong? She said, that's the pastor of my church. So fast forward, you know,
yeah.
I come here in 2009, New Year's Eve, and I want to meet Pastor Rick. I call up the secretary and I say, hey, listen, I'm James Jim Laritz. I'm coming out for, you know, New Year's, and I'll be there for the Sunday after New Year's. I want to meet Pastor Warren. I used to play for the Yankees, the Angels, the Dodgers, everybody else. And, oh, Mr. Laritz, I'm sure Mr. Warren would love to meet you. It's a great story, but he takes the week off after church, after Christmas, because he does so many services.
Right, right.
So I said, oh, gosh, okay. So sure enough, Michelle and I go to the church because I want to see the church. I want to see what Saddleback is. It's what changed my life
yeah.
and was getting me through my trial. So I wanted to see it. Well, sure enough, we go into the service and we're sitting there and, you know, the pastor's giving the service and he comes up and he says, I'd like to just make an announcement real quick. He said, on Christmas Eve, Pastor Rick stood up in front of you and asked our congregation for $200,000 for programs that he wanted to get going in the church. And, you know, we want to thank you because we wound up getting $2.4 million between now and, you know, the service. He said, and someone's here to say thank you. And all of a sudden, Rick Warren walks out on the stage. And I'm telling you, David, I had goosebumps.
Nice.
And I grabbed Michelle's hand. I said, I'm going to meet this guy. And she said, Jimmy, it's not that easy. I said, why not? She said, well, because, you know, he's got security. He's a pretty big guy. So I said, okay. I said, who do you know here? She said, I know the choir guy. I've been in the prayer group with him. Right. You know, we've been praying for you.
I know the choir guy. Yeah. I know the ticket guy.
Nice. So the guy's name was Rick Munchow. And as soon as the service was over, I jetted to the front stage. And I said, Rick. And he turned over and he came over and Michelle was standing behind me and he said, yeah, how you doing? I said, hey, I said, my name's Jim Laritz. I used to play for the Yankees. And he goes, you didn't play for the Yankees. I was like, okay. He goes, you played for my Angels. He knew exactly who I was.
Nice.
And I said, you know, I'm going through this trial. I said, you know, the purpose-driven life has really given me strength. And I really want an opportunity to meet Rick Warren. And he looked over my shoulder and he goes, that's your girlfriend? I said, yeah. He goes, oh my God, I've been praying for you. Because Michelle had been praying.
Yeah, yeah.
He never told her who it was. She never told him. So he didn't know that. So he said, absolutely, let's go. And so he takes us backstage and we go back there and we meet Rick. And Rick kind of knows a little bit about my name. I mean, he knows who I am. And a little bit about what I was going through, surprisingly, because it was covered nationally. And so I tell him the whole thing. I tell him about how the state attorney's doing this on purpose and I'm being framed for a lot of things. And, you know, but it's scary. And then I'm having a hard time and I'm just praying. And I said, the purpose driven life is really helping me get through this. Long story short, after sharing some things and talking, he put his hands on Michelle and I, and he said a prayer. And David, to this day, I'm to tell you what happened. So he put his arms on us and he said, I'm going to pray for these two. I want to pray for Jim that he has the strength to get through what he's going through, that the jury be just. And they see through the smoke and mirrors of what the state is trying to create. But most of all, I want you to give Jim the strength to be able to see this to the very end. And at the time I was just like, okay. I mean, it was powerful, but at the time I didn't really know see it to the very end. I mean, obviously that's what we're going to have to do.
Right.
Well, 2 months before trial, all the evidence about the other driver got thrown out. Now, David, you're talking about cocaine in the system, marijuana. We're talking
alcohol, texting,
everything.
Yeah, this was a
slam dunk,
right?
For us,
yeah. She was a train wreck,
exactly. To show that I wasn't responsible for the accident.
Sure.
That, you know, but so all of that evidence is going to get thrown out because the condition of the other driver doesn't matter. And the state had claimed that they had four witnesses that had me going through this red light. Well, that's, you know, the state has the burden of proof. So the judge goes on what she says. So we still end up going to trial.
Yeah, without the evidence.
Without the evidence. And my attorney comes to me and says, Jim, I think that plea is, you should take it.
Yeah.
And I said, David, I can't. I said, I've been
given I've been there, man.
On higher authority, awesome. I've been given to see this to the end. I'm going to see it to the end. I got faith that something's going to, I said, if I have to perjure myself on the stand, I will get all the information.
Cancel. You didn't hear that here.
but I would have.
Right.
Because I wanted the truth out there. Right. And I felt like if the truth is out there, no matter what had happened to me, at least I knew I would get my life back eventually.
Right.
So long story short, you know, we went through with the trial and sure enough, after 21 days, and the jury came to the conclusion.
They 21 said, days.
21 days.
For a car accident. Wow. Yeah,
and well, there was death involved. I understood that. But the jury said they threw the charge out. Oh, I'm sorry. First of all, the judge threw out the 15-year charge.
Yeah.
After the state prosecution had rested because there was no evidence of me ever going through a red light.
Right.
There was not. Matter of fact, their one witness said my light was yellow. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it was so obvious to the judge that he threw out the first charge.
Yeah.
The only other two charges were that whether or not the accident was caused by my blood alcohol level being over a 0.08.
Yep.
I would have got
approximate cause.
I would have had a 4 year, it was called DUI U-ball. Mm-hmm. And I would have got a 4 year sentence on that.
Is that a felony too?
That's a felony.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would have a 4 year jail sentence.
You know, and I know you got off and vindicated and you've moved forward. It's interesting because when we met, you know, in New York at Joe Namath's golf tournament,
right.
Obviously I knew who you were, and a mutual friend of mine, I asked him to introduce us, which you probably didn't know. What I didn't know is that not only did you live right around the block from me, but you know, the spiritual side of what you do.
Right.
You know, I separate religion and spirituality because I believe in all religions that believe in the truth and the purpose and all the things that you believe. Rick Warren's one of my favorite guys, Joel Osteen. I listen to those guys. I read those guys. I preach or teach very similar concepts, just in a non, you know,
well, yeah, I mean, listen, the teachings that you do, you know, because I've been here now for 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the business model of how to be successful.
Yeah.
Rick Warren has the model of how to be a successful Christian.
Right.
You know, there's different levels there. And that's what I find. I think it was when you and I met, I think that's one of the reasons why we connected so quickly, besides the Cleveland and all the other things.
Exactly what I was getting to.
Yeah, because I think I had already been through that spiritual journey in learning through Rick's and again, my baseball career and learning through how to deal with that and be successful. I mean, I played for many managers that I didn't like, but we still were successful, you know, and
the circumstances though, like for me, like I was in a civil side of it, not criminal. Right. And I lost everything and people were lying and, you know, evidence was my lawyer committed malpractice, you know, and it was too late for me. Even when I got a big judgment for the malpractice, I was in bankruptcy, so the bankruptcy court was getting the money. There's nothing to save me except for the fact, like, and you'll relate to this, is like when I look at Jim Leyritz, you know, when everything seems to go wrong, right? Because that's what you feel, right?
Like
I used to tell my wife, I'm like, oh, I get choked up right now, going, oh, the hits keep coming. But it prepared me because I'm an entrepreneur, right? Yeah. And what I went through and what I go through any day is minor compared to that. Like once you make it to the other side, right? And you're sitting there and you're like, you know what? As long as I can look up, I can get up.
Yep.
That's literally where I got to some days.
Well, here's what I'll tell you. I spent 12 days in jail during the whole thing. Another thing where I was accused of domestic violence and had to prove that I did that.
Another circumstance, right.
Exactly. But it was one of those days, Dave, I was laying in there and, you know, 12 days in a jail cell is not good for anybody.
Yeah.
But
that's Daryl Strawberry.
Exactly. And I'm laying there feeling sorry for myself. And one of the strengths that God gave me through that time was, of course, the only book you get in jail is the Bible.
Right.
And so I'm reading Psalms and I'm reading everything in there and I'm reading this thing. And
they don't give connected to goodness in the
No.
Was it Bradley?
You got to get that in
on
there.
That, buddy. I got to get connected to goodness in there.
But I'm sitting there and I'm starting to feel sorry for myself. And I'm starting to that weakness again, that strength that I had so much that I was going and laying there going, God, you know, I didn't even see my wife or ex-wife that night. How am I sitting here in jail paying this price? Because you know the truth. You know, again, why is this happening? And I'm feeling sorry for myself. And the one thing that I don't know why God had put it in my brain was stop feeling sorry for yourself. You have a brother-in-law who's going through Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yep.
He doesn't have an opportunity to get better. You're like, you're in a temporary situation right now. He's not. You have a chance to get out of this. Quit feeling sorry for yourself and figure out a way that you're going to bounce back from this because your brother-in-law doesn't have that opportunity. You want to feel sorry for somebody, feel sorry for him, not yourself.
Right.
And really that's what the strength that got me through that 12 days was like, why? Okay, there's no reason for me to feel sorry for myself. My situation is temporary. I know I have the truth on my side. So when I get out and I get my opportunity in front of the judge and say, this never happened, it'll happen again.
Right.
Just like in my, in the time, I'm still going through my big trial. So I'm going, okay, I'll get through this first one now and then the next trial.
Right. And the news just eats all this stuff up, exactly. Right?
Well,
right.
And that's just, you know, the pluses that I get from being a superstar and a New York guy and always being in the paper is also the negative when you get into these situations. And I think you'll attest to this. Anytime you get yourself into the system, even though our system eventually works, it's the worst place to be.
Yeah.
Because after going through what I went through, and both on the family court side for custody and also for the trial, I've learned that half the evidence and half the stuff never comes in.
Right.
So the jury that who's ever judging you is not getting to judge you on the facts of everything that has happened. And it's the hardest thing to do to sit there and to listen to people lie straight up.
Yeah.
And you can't say, hold on, they're lying.
You can't say anything. Yeah. And it's so hard, right? Because I was surrounded by a bunch of liars.
Oh, yeah.
And even worse, because everybody was losing their money in 2008, 2009 during my civil trial, right?
Right.
It was even worse that I was an easy target. And this is where your wife's thing, your ex-wife comes in,
oh, yeah.
Is you become a target for blame, shame, and justification.
Yeah.
So anyone else that's having difficulties, they were either losing their money or something else happened, like your wife was at. It was so easy for them just to throw you. Like I had people that would say, you know, and like my wife's close friend, right? Oh, well, your husband's going to sue us because you guys are having financial difficulties. And she was projecting her insecurity because her husband was a thief. And
right.
He knew that I know that he committed fraud and thought that I would project and start blaming other people.
Oh, yeah.
The whole time I lost, and I lost a lot of money, Jim, I never, ever asked anybody. I was owed hundreds of thousands of dollars. My wife would say, well, call up so-and-so. He owes you this. You stroked him a check for 20 grand to save his mom's house. Right? You did this. I said, I won't.
Right.
They know I'm in trouble. If they had it, they would reach out to me. All I'm going to do is ruin those relationships by calling someone and putting them in, saying, hey, I gave you. I didn't. When I give, it's unconditionally. In fact, at that moment of time when I finally went bankrupt, I changed my signature on my emails to unconditionally. Because I was going to live my life because I had been like you.
Yep.
And it's actually, and you know, we'll finish with this because we got a few minutes, but there is a freedom of understanding that once I don't give anyone else control of my life, when you call it God, right? You gave God control of your life.
Well, yeah,
you're completely free.
My father taught me one thing when I was a kid, and he said the most important thing, and it's kind of like your thank you. Every day you get up, you look at the person that you're brushing your teeth with, and that's who you have to answer to that day. And before you go to bed, you have the same person to answer to. There's only one other person that's important, and that's God.
Right.
And he said, you know, that was my higher power. And that was, to me, the best advice he could ever give me, because you're going to have naysayers. You're going to have people that, even after proving everything that was wrong, that was not true, you're still going to have people go, oh, well, he's an athlete. He got off.
Right.
You know, yeah, he got lucky.
Because you're Jim Leyritz.
Oh, he got lucky. Or, you know, something.
Or they just didn't hear that you got off. You
right.
Know, I still today, because I'm a good friend of yours and a promoter of yours and, you know, a big fan still of Jim Leyritz, the person.
Right.
Right. I love the clutch baseball player, but I'm a big fan of Jim Leyritz. Someone will say, oh, yeah, well, Jim was, you know, Jim went to jail for, I said, whoa, yeah. No, he didn't. Jim got off because he didn't do it.
Right.
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't hear that.
Oh, yeah.
Still today, because I live here in Orange County, or we're in New York a lot, Jim. I mean, you're the only one I know that lives in the same neighborhood as me, but is in New York more than I am.
Yeah.
So I get it. But most people, I will tell you that, you know, and if, not to stroke your ego, but most people think the world of Jim Leyritz, right? But you only hear from the 1 out of 100 or 1 out of 1,000.
Well, when I was coming back from all this after the court case and everything else, there was a guy in New York that was one of the highest reputation rebuilding counselors, and you know it cost like 10 grand to hire the guy, and you know one of the guys that I worked with said, hey, listen, maybe you should talk to this guy, you know, to rebuild your reputation because of everything you've been through and get some things out. And it was interesting. I met with him And the first thing he looked at me, because he knew me from my Yankee days and my as a player and
right.
all the charity and what the cops, you know, the police, you know, benevolent associations and
the veterans,
all the, you know, the two children I got adopted into a family.
Yeah.
He knew all those things. And he looked at me and he said, Jimmy, I could take your 10 grand. But all I can tell you is you're not like some of these guys that all of a sudden have to start anew because they got in trouble.
Right.
You've been doing this all your life. Just go back to what you're doing. And you know what? I'm sorry, but it's not going to happen right away. You're not going to get your name back right away. But just keep being the person you are, and everything will come back. Well, here we are now, almost 8 years later, and life is starting to come back.
And our timing's aligned, right? Like, our brands have never been bigger.
Exactly.
We're making money. We're helping people.
Well, and that's the biggest thing. David, one of the beautiful things that I loved about when I met you, I was doing philanthropic work already, but one of the things that really, really brought me to you guys, you and Warren, was the fact that there always was a philanthropic tie, or there was a give back. And of course, the motto, make a lot of money, help a lot of people, have a lot of fun, is exactly what I wanted to do, because I needed to make money. I need to get back on my feet. At the same time, I do have a platform that allows me to go out and change lives. And it's one of the promises I made when I walked out of the courtroom that day. I had said to the judge, I didn't know I was leaving. I didn't know I was, because I still was facing 6 months after right. I got off of everything else, just for a plain DUI. I didn't know I was leaving. So I stood up and the judge gave me an opportunity to speak. And I said, when I walk out of this courtroom today, and you know, my attorney was like, after I said that, he's like, after it was all over with, he goes, you got real big balls to say that. You didn't know you were walking out of here.
Right.
I said, when I walk out of here today, I will make sure of two things. That one, I will continue to change lives and make people better. But number two, that this woman's life will not be in vain. That I will make sure that I will tell everybody that if you have one drink or two drinks, you do not get
which
behind
is our
the
motto,
wheel.
Right?
Exactly.
Do not step behind a wheel. Except, one sip of alcohol.
Exactly.
Well, you know, I wish I had 2 hours because I knew I would, because I didn't get to the Yankee more stuff, but we'll have you back on. You know, I'm here with an incredible person, the king of New York and the king of Sports One marketing, that's for sure. This is Entrepreneur Playbook with Jim Leyritz and Dave Meltzer, CEO of Sports One Marketing. Until next time, make a lot of money, help a lot of people, have a lot of fun. Thanks,
Amen.
Jim.
Thank you.
Playbook is produced by Nathan Lotka, and our media partner is Entrepreneur.com. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday when we feature another story on how a sports icon went from the playing field to the boardroom.